Welcome to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney. I am the founder and editor of Raging Chicken Press. And each week we check in with our Capitol correspondent, Sean Kitchen, on the good, bad, and the ugly that is Harrisburg, PA. We are now on Podbean, Stitcher, Google Play, and of course iTunes. So subscribe to the podcast and give us some feedback. Raging Chicken Radio is a project of Raging Chicken Press. Check us out and all of our citizen journalism at RagingChickenPress.org. And if you like what you see, hey, click on that support and membership tab and become a member for as little as $5 a month. Seriously, for as much as a good cup of coffee or a good beer, you can help support the amazing work that we're trying to do here at Raging Chicken Press. Investigative, hard-hitting, pull-no-punches journalism. $5 a month. Become a member and help support us to help us keep this work going. And as usual, if you're interested in contributing to Raging Chicken Press, just drop us an email at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com or send us a direct message on Twitter. And we're at RC Press on Twitter. We began Raging Chicken Press almost 5 years ago to provide a platform for homegrown progressive citizen journalism and media activism. So if you've got something to say or you just want to learn how to do this work, drop us an email at ragingchickenpress@gmail.com and let's get started. And I'd like to give a shout out to those folks who emailed between last week and this week. We're going to have some new contributors coming on board within the next couple of weeks, is my guess. I'm really, really psyched about it. Getting some great feedback on the podcast. We're going to have adding some additional people to the podcast. This is just an exciting time, right, in our 5-year history here at Raging Chicken Press. So, to start things off today, I got to say happy birthday, Rick Smith, right? Today is Rick Smith's birthday. For those of you listening to the podcast, if you don't know Rick Smith, Rick hosts a labor-oriented radio show based out of Harrisburg, PA, called The Rick Smith Show. You can check it all out at therickSmithShow.com. And Rick is clearly the strongest voice for the working class in Pennsylvania and beyond. So if you get a chance, go to his Facebook page, go to his webpage, listen to his show, and give him a shout out and say happy birthday, Rick, and tell him that Raging Chicken Press sent you. So today we'll be doing a little election reflection, right? Since it's been 1 week since the all important Indiana primary, and today, of course, perfect day to do it. It is the West Virginia primary. So we're going to talk a little bit about what's gone on. I mean, it's a really big day, a big week, actually, in politics, national politics in particular. So we're going to get into that. We're also going to get into a story that recently broke about an FBI corruption probe into the PA legislature. Thank you very much. It's reported by a team of Philadelphia Inquirer journalists, and Sean's been kind of talking a little bit about this and going to probing into it. And then we'll see about where we can go from there. What's going to happen this year's election, kind of coming off today's West Virginia primary. And we'll talk a little bit about some of the stories that we're working on. So, Sean, welcome back. Out to Coop.
Thank you. I had a little technical difficulty, but I was able to jump in right now. So awesome. I hear before we get into things, I hear you don't have to vote today if you're living in West Virginia. Supposedly.
Yeah, it's great. So Donald Trump. So I can say I had an awesome opportunity yesterday. Yesterday I got to go. I got to be in the audience at the Late Show, Stephen Colbert. My wife and I, my mother-in-law, we went out there and we kind of got on the show. It was fantastic. We had second row seats. It was awesome. And one of the skits that he did was on a speech that Donald Trump gave in West Virginia. Not a skit, I shouldn't say. It's actually Donald Trump doing the skit himself. But he basically told West Virginia miners, look, primary's over. Don't worry about it. Don't waste your vote on me tomorrow. Save it for the general election. As if you only have one vote and you have to be careful how you use it, right?
You're allowed to one vote and choose wisely.
Oh, it was unbelievable. It was just unbelievable. And then he went off on this weird thing about hairspray, about how pissed off he is that he can't, like, you know, use the hairspray with the fluorocarbons, right, because it destroys the environment and now his hair doesn't stand still.
You know who he is, Donald Trump? If Donald Trump could, he'd get into a pickup truck and start rolling coal, like, you know, just because he can.
Donald Trump.
His approval rating would shoot through the roof after that. What did Rachel Maddow say last week? It's raining sugar.
It's raining sugar.
And they're just eating it up.
Yep. Yeah, I think that's about right. So what's your take on this now? I mean, you know, Trump is has locked up the nomination. You've got Cruz and Kasich has dropped out, and they're basically handed it over to Trump.
Kasich didn't drop out. Kasich stopped his world eating tour, pretty much.
Yeah. Well, okay, fine.
I mean, come on now. If you asked me in the summertime where we would go with this, I would have told you you're nuts that Donald Trump would not have got the nomination. I was in the I was in that crowd where no, this guy's a joke. He's not going to get it. And at the time, Rick Smith and I were talking about this constantly, and Rick was saying, no, he's going to take this to the convention and he's going to win it. And I told him, Rick, you're nuts. This is never going to happen. And here we are. He's taking it to the convention and he won it.
No, that's right. You know, I've never been a doubter. I've never been a doubter of Trump. And I tell you, not because I think he's good. I mean, the guy's like, this is horrible. But because, you know, it's also, you know, what Rick Smith has been saying, what Sam Cedar has been saying is like, you know, this guy has basically walked in to a situation where, you know, the Republican Party has basically built a base based around racism, around, kind of anti-woman legislation. Racism, sexism, you go right across the nativism, all that kind of stuff. But up until now, they've kind of used the dog whistle politics. Well, basically Trump did. He just walked in and kind of put that suit on. And, you know, he just said, why are we using this whistle?
Let's and he wore it proudly. It.
Yeah, he wore it proudly. And
I don't have a TV in my apartment. Mm-hmm. So most of my news comes through the Young Turks or other online platforms. So I barely have a time to sit down and watch MSNBC. But there are live streams out there where I can watch MSNBC live on the internet. And I decided to watch MSNBC on Wednesday night. And Lawrence O'Donnell at 10 o'clock had a really great intro saying Donald Trump didn't just we were wrong about Donald Trump. He set this foundation 4 years ago when he ran for a couple months for president. And basically planted that seed of nativism with questioning Obama's birth certificate in 2012 when that issue was settled. But he brought those fears back up again, and he planted that seed, and that seed germinated. And here he is right now taking the nomination, taking it to the convention. He's going to win.
Well, let's not give Trump too much credit here, because I would argue, say, yeah, he did that. But let's also remember that the Republican Party and the Republican Party apparatus, which includes Fox News, just seized that stuff and went with it whole hog, right?
Well, no, it's not like he reinvented the wheel here. He just exploited something, let it fester, and then he exploited it some more. I mean, he started his campaign off with this grand lie that we're going to build a wall to Mexico.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And what happened? He stoked that hatred. You know, he was able to fan. I mean, I thought I would never see anyone win in an overtly racist campaign or primary the way he has. But this also isn't surprising. This is what the GOP has built over the past 20 or 30 years. And now they have to deal with the Frankenstein they created.
That's exactly it. I think that's the best metaphor for what's going on in the GOP right now. It's like, you know, so for a lot of these, you know, Republican Party establishment figures who are, you know, saying Donald Trump is destroying the party and all that kind of stuff, you know, I find it so, number one, completely disingenuous, because there's no accountability to the fact that they created this monster.
You know, it's not just the right wing talk radio either. It's the Andrew Sullivan.
That's correct.
It's the David Brooks. It's the intellectual leaders of the party who are now trying to disavow us. No, you created this. You're the ivory tower Republican news columnist from the New York Times or the Atlantic or something like that. This you've had a part of this with Rush Limbaugh. And the others. Now Alex Jones is taking over the party's right-wing talk radio. Glenn Beck. I mean, you're equally as responsible for this.
No, and I think really what's set this this election season apart more than anything else is the fact that when they did this, it's basically the GOP has been contracting out some of the most kind of explicit, like racist, sexist, nativist stuff to talk radio, to these kind of extremists in there. But essentially, I think they counted on the fact that what's going to hold this all together, what's going to keep this loose kind of sets of affiliations together in order to get Republican candidates to win was the big money. Right, was the billionaire backers that were kind of like funding this whole apparatus. What Donald Trump did, the one difference with Donald Trump is he comes in, right, and he's not reliant on those super PACs, right? He's not a lot reliant upon the Koch brothers, right? So he's essentially been getting free media, right? And then using his own story and his own wealth to kind of shield him from some of that stuff. So they've lost control. They haven't been able to dictate in the same way that they have been in the past. And so now that's what they're scrambling to do. All these insiders are finding out that their positions are in jeopardy. Not Trump's, not the parties, but their position.
It's not just the free media that the cable outlets have been giving him. It's the phoners. He's been able to call into a morning talk show on a daily basis. I mean, he's calling in, you know, on CNN and MSNBC on a regular basis. Where are these news editors saying, no, stop it. You are being irresponsible as journalists or as news commentators. This is not what we're supposed to be doing. We're making ourselves part of the story and not, you know, reporting on it. That's the biggest failure of the media this election cycle, is where you're allowing one person to constantly call in from his bathroom or in it from just sipping a cup of coffee to serious interviews and let him defend what you're reporting on.
Right. I mean, I would even say that, you know, if you talk about the most serious failings has been Hillary is actually kind of hitting this point hard right now. It's not necessarily just the fact they allowed to phone in, although that is just crazy, is the fact that they've treated him like entertainment. Right. Because basically, you know, what's been behind all that is like, you know, you basically are showing a reality TV show, which is actually bringing in the ad dollars. Right. That for the longest time, the kind of CEOs, the head of the media corporations, right, and a lot of the kind of online or a lot of the cable journalists said, you know, this is basically going to be harmless, right? We're going to bring people in. They're going to be watching this. They're going to watch, you know, the shit show that is Donald Trump. And then they're going to, you know, they're going to stay tuned and we're going to bring in the ad dollars. By the time they actually said, oh, my God, this guy's actually going to be, you know, going to be the nominee, it was too late, right? They had already helped build that. So, you know, it just goes also to show that what would it look like if the CEOs of these media companies, instead of saying, well, how do we bring in the ad dollars, were saying, no, we have a job to do, which is to hold these politicians' feet to the fire and ask the hard questions. Right. And, you know, frankly, that's the media environment that we live in, is that we have this for-profit mega corporations that, you know, rule our media environment. And, you know, that's what you get. You get politics as entertainment as opposed to, you know, serious journalism, which is holding these people's feet to the fire.
Yeah. And one of the things, like, reflecting upon this, it's amazing how many authors are out there that have predicted over the past 10 or 15 years, basically saying the right is marching towards the style of fascism, and you people are just doing nothing to stop it. I mean, Chris Hedges has been sounding this alarm for how many years now? For decades. You know, here you have someone who, you know, covered the downfall of despots across the world in some of the most hell-driven landscapes you'd ever want to be in. And here he's seeing the same things happening on the home front, and no one's believing him. And now 10 years of talking about American fascism within the right, you now have Donald Trump.
Yeah, this, you know, this is a really good point.
So everything you just nailed on in that last little rant you had is everything Chris Hedges has been talking about for the past 10 years.
Absolutely. And go ahead, sorry.
I know, and here we are.
No, exactly. And I think that, you know, that's a really good point. Like that Hedges has been doing this. And, you know, I don't want to paint too broad a brush here because I've got to do our own kind of accountability here. Is like really, you know, when I'm that last little rant, as you said, just kind of was what I was talking about was primarily what we saw on cable news, right? That we should point out that there's been really excellent reporting that's been done by people like Chris Hedges, like by reporters, by print journalists, right, who have done that kind of investigation. But, you know, again, is they don't have the megaphone. They don't have that kind of network that you do on cable journalism. So really cable news has led the way on this. But we should also acknowledge that, look, there was really good reporting that's been going on this for this kind of stuff for a while. Right. And the question is how do we get the highlight? How do we get the focus on that kind of journalism as opposed to the, you know, politics as entertainment stuff?
Yeah, no, it's correct. Because, I mean, this just did not happen overnight. We didn't just like fall asleep for 30 years and woke up and like, wow, what just hit us? You know, this has been festering for a while. And, you know, especially our major media outlets, the ones that have the largest megaphones are not holding accountable the Republican Party. They're saying, well, it's just both sides doing it. You know, the older Democrats are just as crazy as the Republicans. And now we have someone like Donald Trump running for president because we're not holding accountable. We're not telling people one of our political parties has gone off the rails.
Right. So I'll tell you what. So we're coming up to a break now. When we come back after the break, I want to talk a little bit about kind of where we see things going from here. And we've been focused a little bit on Trump. But I'm also curious kind of your take on kind of where the campaigns go from here, and looking at some of the matchups. And, you know, we still have a primary going on today, which Hillary Clinton has basically said she's probably going to lose to Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders is putting a really strong showing there. She started running TV ads again after she kind of claimed to be moving towards a general election. Like, Sanders is not going to go away. So we'll kind of talk a little bit about that. And then we want to kind of look at this FBI probe into the PA state legislators and corruption, which is actually having some significant impacts. So we'll get back into that after the break. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. We'll be right back.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that as many as 90,000 people rallied for the passage of the Equal Rights Amendment in Grant Park in Chicago, Illinois. The proposed amendment to the Constitution read, "Equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." The idea to amend the Constitution to ensure equal rights for women was first proposed by Alice Paul in 1923. In the late 1960s, with the second wave feminist movement, the push for the amendment gained momentum. At the time, women only made 59 cents for each dollar earned by men. Not all labor leaders supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Some worried that the proposed constitutional amendment would nullify existing labor protections for women in the workforce. They instead advocated for legislation around specific issues faced by women. Myra K. Wolfgang, a vice president of the Hotel and Restaurant Employees and Bartenders International Union, testified against the ERA before the Senate in 1970. The ERA passed Congress in 1972, but in order for the amendment to go into effect, 38 states had to ratify it. 30 quickly did so, but then a backlash against the legislation began to gain momentum. Illinois was the only northern state that was a holdout for ratifying the amendment. A massive rally was planned. That morning, the Chicago Tribune described the crowd that was expected, including representatives from labor, religion, show business, politics, and the home. Despite this massive turnout, the Equal Rights Amendment failed to win enough support in Illinois. The amendment fell three states short of becoming the law of the land. Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coop podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and I'm sitting here talking with Sean Kitchen. He's our assistant editor and capital correspondent. So, Sean, when we talked about in the first segment, we talked a lot about Trump and the kind of the craziness that is the Trump, and but also some of the seriousness of it. And, you know, one of the things that has disturbs me a little bit or concerns me for the same reason I was concerned about Trump to begin with, is that now you've got a lot of folks on the Democratic side of the aisle, right, on the left in general, who look at Trump and they're like, "Ah, this is going to be a cakewalk for the Democrats. That Hillary's just going to take him down." And believe me, there's a big chunk of the evidence that seems to suggest that when it moves to the general, Republicans are not going to, or that Donald Trump is going to lose big. And you know, if you look at some of the most recent PPP poll. Actually, Sanders is still shows in that kind of, you know, national matchup polls. Sanders is still way out in front, shows that he can win by the biggest margins nationally. But as you know, those national polls are a little bit deceiving. You got to get into the state by state stuff. But still, Sanders is kind of out in front on that. But with Clinton, with Hillary probably most likely getting the nomination, some of the polls that have coming out is, you know, yes, they're showing that Hillary, has the potential to really trounce Trump. But there's also some stuff from that recent poll that are, you know, is a little bit more concerning. So, for example, when people were asked about in that PPP poll, they're asked about how comfortable you would be with certain people as your nominee. And when they asked Republicans, right, only 21% of Republicans polled said that they would be uncomfortable with Trump, right? And why that number is important is because that's the same number of Democrats who said that they would be uncomfortable with Hillary Clinton. as their nominee. But what, why that's important is because there's this big gap between what you see, you know, in the media about Republican, official Republicans, the establishment Republicans, the GOP, who are kind of leading the party, all the, their cries about, you know, the party's falling apart, everyone, no one's going to come out and everything. That doesn't seem to be true with the Republican base. So when we move, so we start moving towards the general, my concern is like, you know, that you, you take Trump for granted again. And Trump can really push up. And it seems to be, I'm trying to remember who was talking about this. I think Steve Kornacki was talking about it earlier this morning. But it, in some case, you can make the argument, at least, that Trump, he may not be so worried about the gender gap. Because remember, gender goes both ways, right? It's not, gender doesn't just mean women. Gender also means men. And if you look at the kind of the polls, again, this is a Quinnipiac poll. It's showing that, you know, if you look at some key states, Florida, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, in Pennsylvania, right here, Hillary is get plus 19 with women, right? That's huge, right? I mean, she's getting the women's vote. However, Trump is plus 21 with men, right? So is he making a decision that he is just going to go whole hog on this kind of sexist line in order to appeal to the sexism in men? And you know, that's kind of a dangerous scenario. So I'm curious how, you know, what's your take on where things are going now? And as we kind of start thinking about the general up ahead,
I will disagree with you.
Okay.
I am in the other camp. I think this is a runaway for the Democrats, but I also don't think it's a runaway where they should just like let up. This is their election to lose. Mm-hmm. I think that it's time to put your foot down on the throat of, you know, these Senate elections. You know, I think you're putting in so many more Senate races that are usually never in play, like Arizona, mm-hmm. which is, you know, fairly a conservative state. John McCain said if Trump gets the nomination, my political career is over because it's going to motivate Latinas to vote.
Yeah, I think he's going to lose.
Yeah, I think he's done, which is like just earth shattering. And then you just had Chuck Grassley come out, which now I was in play for Democrats, and Grassley came out and said, you know, I think Trump would pick a really good Supreme Court nominee, so he's doubling mm-hmm. down on not filling in. Mm-hmm. There's two things. He's doubling down on not filling in the Supreme Court vacancy that is left with Scalia passing away. Mm-hmm. But he's also doubling down on Trump, and he's in a situation where, you know, Iowa may not go Democrat, but there's a fairly competent Democratic state.
Right, right, right.
You know, and she just happened to pop up after Scalia passed away, and now, you know, stranger things have happened, but now possibly Iowa's in play for the Democrats. I start looking on how to start winning these elections, and I start pinning down ballot candidates to Donald Trump, and not just through, like, they come out supporting Trump, but they support the policies that Trump supports. You know, you have these pro-lifers come out and support punishing women. Boom, mm-hmm. you're just like Donald Trump. Even though you've never said a single word about the man.
Well,
I think you start linking together candidates to Trump through their policies and their rhetoric.
Well, and that seems to be the direction that they're going, right? I mean, so some of the original or some of the ads that are out already with like McCain and then Iowa and some other ones too as well are going that direction. They're trying to pin these like the Senate campaigns, they're trying to basically pin the Republican candidate to Trump and basically saying, look, here it is. And, you know, since so many of them have come out and said, look, oh, yeah, I would support him if he's a nominee. That's a nice, easy link to bring it together. But let me throw a scenario at you. All right. And just kind of and you could talk me down from this one, too, as well. Right. So here's where I get concerned. I get concerned when we see where a whole lot of the energy is on the Democratic side is in the kind of the Bernie Sanders campaign. Right. Bringing out all sorts of people right to the campaign, and, you know, into the political process and so on. And those are potential voters come the fall. They're not automatically locked in. So my concern is this, is that Hillary's campaign has just made some moves this past week that suggest that they're pulling out this kind of new Democratic playbook again, like new Democratic Party playbook. And that's the one from the old Clinton's folk and the new one, what we saw with Obama too as well. The idea is that you're going for the quote unquote middle voters, the moderate voters, and even some of the moderate Republicans and try to bring them into the process, right? That's the same kind of move that actually gets the people that are involved in the Sanders campaign, that gets them kind of like dejected, right? That it shows them that this is the, you know, this is more politics as usual. You're going more corporate Democrat kind of route. And so she's actually, there's been some reports that have been coming out that she's courting Republican donors, right? Those donors from the Jeb Bush campaign, those donors from the Rubio campaign, and trying to get them to support her. Now, if I'm sitting there, I'm an ardent kind of Sanders supporter. I believe there's corruption in politics. I'm this influence that those parties are too much the same, that we need to actually redefine a progressive agenda. And I look at that move. That move looks to me like this is just a kind of right-wing Democrat, moderate Republican. This is who she is. She's been talking to us about being progressive, but she's really not. I'm not saying that's the case, but it concerns me that that could affect turnout. Meanwhile, the Trump people, right, and some of the folks on the GOP side are going to come out. I mean, talk me down from that scenario.
I don't know. But Trump's banking on, in that scenario, Trump's banking on low voter turnout. And, you know, how do you...
I'm not saying Trump is banking on this. I'm saying this could be a flaw in the Democratic Party's campaigning. That's what I'm saying. I don't think this is Trump doing this. I think this is the Democrats hurting themselves.
Maybe, possibly. It'll be interesting to see. I mean,
man, I was looking for a little hope here, and now you're kind of like, you know, I don't consider that. Oh my God, the sky's falling.
I wasn't thinking about that, but I mean, I'm looking more of an, like, I'm a single issue voter this time around. I know Sanders has no shot at winning it, you know, for quite some time, but the Supreme Court justice, that's the biggest issue we're facing. I think that's the biggest issue is like, that's driving me out to vote this year is because, you know, there's a possibility you get two or three Supreme Court. I mean, Scalia's going to flip. There's a possibility of a second, you know, one flipping with Clarence and the other ones getting pretty old up there. And, you know, you can have a 6-3 majority court for the next generation. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it would be really upsetting if the Democrats squandered that away.
Yeah, it would. And I think, you know, if I had to look, if I were to pick issues, if I'm not like an issue voter, but if I had to pick two issues, if that was somebody was to say, if you had to pick issues that define why you're going to vote for Hillary Clinton come the general, I would have two. One, yes, the Supreme Court nominations. Two would be the war on women. Right. I will bet my bottom dollar that if Hillary Clinton is president, she will veto every piece of legislation that kind of comes to her desk that would negatively impact kind of women's right to choose, women's access to medical care, and the kind of war that the GOP.
And also, if you look at it this year within the Democratic Party, mm-hmm. I think there's what 12 women, right, mm-hmm. senators. Yep. This year, you can possibly add another 8 or 9 Democratic women to yep. that caucus. Imagine the implications of, you know, you have a major American party mm-hmm. with close to 40% of it being a caucus like that, 40% are women. I think that is one of the bigger numbers that I saw over the weekend or over the past week. That's actually like really interesting to think about because, you know, it's not going to be a party dominated by men anymore.
Yep.
It's a possibility that 50, 45%, 40% of the caucus is women. And where do you have that such parity or where do you have such a breakdown like that in the corporate world? You don't.
No, you don't.
You know, you have a caucus of a major American party that's going to be possibly 35 to 45% woman minority.
Yeah,
which is absolutely astounding.
Well, and this gets to the same kind of reason that I would start to say that, like, what kind of voter am I? Is because I'm a movement voter, right? And what I mean by that is that when I'm looking at an election, I'm not looking at, like, okay, just this issue or that issue. I've never liked that frame of like, well, you gotta take the good with the bad, the good outweighs the bad. You do this cost benefit analysis as if what we do in politics is the same thing as what we do in a business, right? What I look at it is I say, okay, in which scenario, right? What's the best, you know, terrain for the kind of social movements, the kind of political movements that we've seen come on the scene? What's the best terrain or the better terrain for that movement to thrive in? And I do believe it is in a Democratic campaign. It is a Democratic administration. And this, I go back again to Sam Cedar. He's done some great kind of analysis on this in the Majority Report when he says, you know, look, if you look at the progressive movement under Bush, right? You're not moving Bush anywhere, right? Progressives were basically shut out of the process entirely under Bush. Yeah, they got mad, but they had no power. And so therefore what happens is that we saw a further turn to the right in terms of policies, saw more attacks on kind of a progressive agenda and so on. under Obama, who is by no means a progressive, right? From my perspective, at least, he still needs to have at least some sort of relationship with that progressive base of the Democratic Party. So in other words, he can be pushed, and he was pushed on gay marriage, right? He's been pushed to kind of bring the gun issue front and center, right? He's been pushed on gender equity. I mean, and, you know, and trade was the one piece that he was going to stick to. But you've built such a strong movement at that point that now the TPP looks in jeopardy. So, I mean,
now, so, mm-hmm. No, let me jump in real quick, because I know we'll probably be hitting up a break soon. Yep. But so the things you're hitting on right now is exactly why Sanders chose to run as a Democrat, right? Because we've talked about this so many times before. You're not going to change the left politics.
Right.
You're not going to change left politics by running as a third party candidate because you don't have the platform. And frankly, you don't have the organization. There's no organizational structure within the Green Party to run a third party candidate, right?
Bingo.
I've seen this personally on the local level. There's just no heart to organize anything right there. The only real organizing you're seeing that's going on third party politics right now is with the Socialist Alternative and other socialist organizations that are pushing for Fight for 15 and issues outside, pushing it through social politics. You're not pushing it through electoral politics. But the Democratic Party is adopting those changes from the inside. Right. And this is where the Burn Your Bus movement has me upset, because it's like it would completely go against everything he ran on. He ran as a Democrat knowing the only way to change progressive politics in the United States is through the Democratic Party. It's not going to come out through an outside third party. So basically, if he either ran as a third party candidate, as an independent or a green in the fall, which he obviously will not, it will go against everything he built, and it would put him and his movement in front of everything else and all the progress that's been made over the past 4 years since Occupy Wall Street started, pretty much.
Yeah.
And it would put himself and his campaign in front of all that stuff that's been built instead of a linear projection. And this is one of the biggest tangents I have with this Burn Your Bust argument, because he's not going to do that. He's not going to put himself and completely throw out everything that's been built up to this point just so he can have a vanity campaign in November with Jill Stein or something like that.
No, I absolutely. And I have to say, you know, this is where, you know, it's so funny is that, you know, the left in this country, you know, it hasn't really been the left since, like, in my view, at least, like, you know, the 1930s. Well, we saw it again in the 1960s and 70s. We saw a big upsurge then too as well. But despite the fact that the left in this country has been the engine for all sorts of changes, right? We're talking about civil rights. We're talking about suffrage. I mean, you go right down the litany of stuff. It's been the left
lately with the minimum wage movement.
Black Lives Matter,
paid sick leave, all these other movements that are happening. It's happening not just because of organized labor, but it's happening because of groups outside the Democratic Party, but they're inside that left tent.
Exactly. And yet, at the same time, what we haven't done, right, on the left, and this drives me nuts, right, is that still when it comes down to like a presidential election or even a midterm for election somehow, we kind of look at these politicians, right, as if like they're the answer, right? Or if they're not perfect, they're not held up to this kind of weird like purity test, then, you know, we're not going to vote for them, or we're going to throw our hands up or something like that. That completely like rejects like the whole notion that you have to build a movement, right? If you're after building a movement, the candidate in that office is not kind of like the leader of your movement. Your movement is the leader of your movement. What has to be the question on the table is what's the scenario that is going to allow that movement to move forward, as opposed to just having to kind of back off and get into a defensive posture. And so it's the same kind of thing. It's like, you know, this is where Sanders is, I think, was and he said this from the beginning. He's like, why am I running the Democratic Party? Well, if you're going to run in this system, right, you know, your only realistic chance, right, is to do it within the Democratic Party. And there's been attempts to do this before. I mean, this is the whole kind of during McGovern, when McGovern kind of his campaign and the people that he put together was about getting rid of, you know, the old behind closed door, smoke filled room kind of process that dominated the Democratic Party, and kind of trying to open it up to a process like a more of a primary process. So, you know, again, I really think we've got to get our heads thinking about building movements, right? And that these elections come up periodically, right? But we have to kind of define the movement on our own terms and push these people in direction. And then, you know, once you start thinking about that, it's, in my mind, it's a no-brainer about, you know, who you vote for in the fall, right? It's like, I'm a Bernie supporter, you know, I'm going to vote for him, I'm going to support him all the way. But, you know, when I come to the fall, I know, right, that if Clinton is in office, we've got more of an opportunity to push her and push her politics, right? Especially given her commitment to gender equity, gun violence, and
plus,
as you've spoken about, a kind of Black Lives Matter stuff.
And plus, like, where's Bernie Sanders going to be more effective? Like, someone told me that Liz Warren should accept a run. If she gets picked to be VP, she should accept it. And I said, absolutely not. Liz Warren needs to stay inside the Senate, where she'll be a strong voice inside the Senate, and she might be a possible future majority leader of that caucus. Yep. You know, I would love to see her try to challenge Schumer for that position, because she has a lot of clout in that caucus, and she built a lot of clout in that caucus real quickly. And she's the person that people come out to see, like Bernie Sanders, when there's a rally in the area. You know, she's the rock star fundraiser for the Democratic Party. I think she could I think she should challenge Schumer, you know, and stay inside the Senate. And Sanders needs to stay inside the Senate as well. He should not take a position outside the Senate.
I don't think he will.
That's where he's most effective.
Yeah, and now he's got, like, what, millions of people on a mailing list, right, that they can use to help mobilize kind of additional policy.
And what's going to happen 2 years from now, 4 years from now, mm-hmm. 6 years from now, he's going to motivate candidates to run for office. So this isn't just going to, like, bam, it's going to happen overnight. No, it's going to start trickling down into local and state politics. You know, and that's where you start cultivating these people. I mean, look at Pennsylvania. How come we don't have Democrats running in, obviously, in central Pennsylvania and rural Pennsylvania? How come we don't have Democrats out there running for office? Okay. Where Sanders and Fetterman, two people, not very religious, one's a Brooklyn Jew, the other one's some 6'8" Neolithic looking figure. Not exactly people you're going to be looking to vote for in central Pennsylvania or rural Pennsylvania. People who are staunchly pro-choice or probably agnostic or atheist in their views, right? Mm-hmm. But they got votes of these rural Pennsylvanians because they ran on an economic progressive campaign.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there's something to be said for, you know, there's been some kind of cool analysis about Donald Trump and about saying that, you know, part of what he's not running on a policy platform. He's running on an attitude, right? On a certain kind of performance. And I think that that progressives, right, people on the left need to learn a lot from that, right? That, you know,
they need to not be afraid of punching someone in the face when they need to, or chucking a brick through someone's window.
Well, not even that. I mean, just, you're talking about, you know, why not speak forthrightly? And this is what I hope Bernie Sanders is teaching people. What Elizabeth Warren has been teaching people is that if you want to garner support, if you want to grow a movement, if you actually want to kind of grow a particular wing, then you actually have to be unafraid and unabashed about speaking about what you stand for. And not being afraid, you know, to go to battle. I mean, what Elizabeth Warren has been doing on Twitter has just been, I mean, has been something else. I mean, she just goes, she'll go after Trump and she'll kind of stand behind, you know, the progressive values that has gotten her where she is today. And I think that we need more of that. Not these Democrats who want to put on the Republican suits, right, to appease, you know, suburban white voters, that's really what it comes down to. I mean, we need people, and this is why I like Fetterman. I mean, Fetterman, you know, he comes out, he's going to speak pretty frankly about a kind of what people need, and he's coming out of a steel community, right, and that, you know, reflects, he's running, and he continues to run, what he's done in Braddock so far, you know, his attitude comes out of that kind of context. And we need more of that on the thing. So I know I'm letting things run long today, but, you know, frankly, folks, this is one of the great things about doing a podcast, right, is that when we get into this kind of discussion, right, we're not bound to just kind of shut things down. But I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some of the stories that we're working on and some little things coming up in the near future, which kind of ties into this podcast. And hopefully we're going to build in the progressive media infrastructure statewide. So this is Kevin Mahoney. This is Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coup podcast. We'll be right back. This is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press. Over the past 5 years, we've brought unapologetic progressive activist media to Pennsylvania and beyond. We've helped hold those in power accountable and shine a light on some amazing activist work.
We've broken national stories and established a reputation as an aggressive citizen media site. As newsrooms close and traditional journalists lose their jobs, hard-hitting investigative news suffers. If we care about our democracy, we have to find new sustainable models of journalism, and frankly, no one's going to do it for us. So take a minute to become a member of Raging Chicken Press. For as little as $5 a month, the price of a good beer or cup of coffee, you will be supporting homegrown progressive journalists and media activists. Go to RagingChickenPress.org and click on the Support and Membership tab to become a member. Leave a one-time donation or learn about other ways you can help. We don't have billionaire backers. Keeping progressive activist media going strong depends on you. Thank you for all your help and support, and keep up the fight.
Welcome back to Raging Chicken Radio's Out to Coup podcast. This is Kevin Mahoney, the editor and founder of Raging Chicken Press, and I'm talking with Sean Kitchen, our Harrisburg correspondent and assistant editor of Raging Chicken Press. So right before the break, I was talking a little about kind of directions that we're going to go. And like I said, let today run a little bit long today because I thought I liked the discussion, right? The fact that we can have this venue, that we can do this and take the time that we need to expand on some issues, I think it's important. So now, up until now, when I said that we went a little long, the reason I say that is because we've been trying to think about this, the Out to Coop podcast, right, as in 30-minute segments. And part of that because we've been working on a project with some other folks, right? I won't name names yet, to work on a kind of more expansive radio project where this podcast could be part of a 30-minute time block on a kind of a more traditional radio format, if you have to put it that way, right? That we can bring progressive voices out there. So if you hear us kind of moving through things quickly at times, that might be why. But the project is not launched yet, so I thought today was appropriate to kind of to take a little time with it. So that's pretty cool. So that's kind of coming up, and it's going to be really awesome in my view to start adding some additional segments on here. I've got some great feedback from people, and probably within the next 2 weeks or so, we're going to be adding some segments to the Out to Coop podcast, interviewing some authors, some kind of education activists, some environmental activists. Got some really cool stuff that we hope to get, some great reporting on some factory farms and impacts on communities. So we'll bring those folks into the mix pretty soon. The other thing I just want to say, I'm just going to say this, I'm excited, is right before we started recording today's podcast, I got a notice that my copy of Where to Invade Next, Michael Moore's film, is going to be at my door today at some point. So I'm very excited about it. I haven't seen the film yet. I'm dying to see it. But it's got me filled with hope, especially some of the talking about some of the educations. You know, you guys, you talk about education in Finland and this kind of stuff, see some of the segments on it. So I'm very excited about that. So, Sean, I know some other things that you kind of got in your mind. What's on your mind?
Well, so the past, I've been dying to actually talk about this. Corruption is so bad in Harrisburg right now that the FBI set up a fake lobbying firm to take a little probe in the legislature, see how bad it actually is. And a story by Angela Columbanis, Craig McCoy, and a couple of other Philadelphia Inquirer writers have been breaking out over the past couple weeks. It's a really interesting thing to follow. I believe it's something we should keep our eye on. Basically, the FBI set up a fake lobbying firm called Textbook BioSolutions Inc. And this, they recruited lobbyists to push their agenda in Harrisburg, which was basically taking old school textbooks and recycling them down into wood pellets for your stove. And they were successful in getting a bill to pass the Senate 49-0, so it was not that controversial of an issue that they took up. But it looks like some people might be scared about this, especially who's involved with it. Rendell's former chief of staff, who also runs the Hershey Trust, mm-hmm. which is the state's largest charitable nonprofit in the state, was nabbed in this. He got caught taking $13,000 in FBI money, pocketing it, instead of distributing that money to political action committees and candidates or political parties who were pursuing this legislation. Seems like he got nabbed for doing something a little stupid. I don't know. I take it he didn't think this was an FBI sting. that he thought he would outsmart the people running this thing, and he did not do that. But it's going to be interesting to see who gets caught up in this.
Yeah,
because basically this just looks at everyday politics in Harrisburg. When I saw the story, I was kind of a little unimpressed that people are actually upset about this, because this is how it works in Harrisburg. They're trying to find a quid pro quo, but this is everyday. This is how the city operates.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you've talked about, these are some of the reporters that broke the story, or some of the reporters that you say are doing some of the best work out of Harrisburg too. And I think that it's important to acknowledge that, you know, there is some really good, really.
I mean,
good
Angela Colombanis. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Angela Colombanis had her name all over the Kathleen Kane stuff. Yep. Over the past couple of years. I mean, this is just continuing like years of work that they're doing in the Capitol, especially Angela Colombanis. You know, it's actually pretty awesome. It's a really neat experience being out in Harrisburg and actually getting to see these people work up close and personal. Like, you get to see them inside the newsroom, inside the press conferences. And, you know, we don't hold conversations with each other, but it's just being out here and actually seeing that and being able to pick their brain sometimes. And it's great just watching them do this.
Yeah, you know, you've talked about this before. You and I have talked about this before, about, you know, this is, you know, some of the craft of journalism. You know, this is not the what led to that story wasn't like, you know, kind of something that was just dropped on her desk and then she reported on it. She had to do a lot of the nitty gritty reporting, a lot of the nitty gritty journalism that kind of that goes into these kind of stories. And you know, you're right. You're saying, you know, that this is just how things work out in Harrisburg. But, you know, just goes to a point that you've made before, that this is the kind of stuff that we need to be reporting on, right? This is the kind of stuff that needs more attention. It's not okay to just throw up our hands and say, well, that's the way things are. That's the way things are done around here. So that was really kind of encouraging to see what's going on.
Yeah, and another thing I think this story should also look at, reforms of our campaign finance system. Mm-hmm. Pennsylvania does not have any campaign finance laws. You can donate unlimited amount of money to any political candidates in our state. And I think that's another issue that should be brought up out of the story, because they're using this money to give $5,000 a shot to state senators, state representatives, and the political parties that were involved in pushing this legislation. Some of the people who took these donations was Senator John Udicek from Scranton, Pennsylvania, Senator Joe Scarnati from Northwestern Pennsylvania, Jefferson County, and then Philadelphia Representative Dwight Evans. So it seems like that this is a casting a wide net along party lines, just among leaders in each party who are willing to push this legislation through. It's going to be really interesting seeing where this is going. Scarnati mentioned that he was promised a office right in his district if he supported the bill. And so that was brought up in one of the meetings. These meetings were recorded, so it's going to be interesting to see if anything comes out of that. And also, I mean, this is continuing the tradition of the FBI in Harrisburg. You know, Rob McCord, like the first 2 weeks I was out in Harrisburg, I saw him get prep walked out of the FBI building. He still hasn't been sentenced.
And this is from that same investigation, right, that took down McCord?
I think this might be a different investigation. There's a possibility that this is a different investigation, because McCord was caught extorting potential campaign donors as he was campaigning. He said, if you don't give money to my gubernatorial campaign, you will not be getting any contracts from the treasurer's office, which was McCord's office at the time. So you can't be doing that stuff today. It's not 30 years ago when you used to get away with that stuff. But it seems like this is actually looking at pay-for-play politics in Pennsylvania, which is, in my opinion, it's alive and well. People don't, Bill, this isn't like the bill on the Hill becomes law, Mr. Smith goes to the Capitol. This is like, you know,
right.
This is, the bill gets introduced, it gets pushed by lobbying groups. Those lobbying groups give these political campaigns, and in return, you know, they might not be set in stone, but their agenda ultimately goes through the legislature. And that's how politics works in Harrisburg, and this FBI case is highlighting that, in my opinion.
Oh, awesome. I mean, I'm so psyched to see it. When you sent me that story, it's like so interesting to see that stuff going on. And, you know, I do think this is one of these places where people who have been arguing that we need to get the money out of politics, that we need to reform campaign finance stuff, this is one of these things where you can really dig in, right? Dig in and push for legislation to get this money out of politics to kind of clean up the system. Pennsylvania traditionally ranks towards the top of corrupt in terms of
governments in the country.
Exactly. So I mean, I think this is a great time, especially with a lot of people activated for the election coming up. This is a perfect way for people to dig in Pennsylvania. As you spend our summers kind of like, you know, giving hell in the state capital.
Yeah, maybe possibly, but I don't really see people doing that. Unfortunately, I'm not really hopeful about our movements in Pennsylvania. We need to get a lot more organized. You know, it's just from watching this, you could actually become a jaded, more cynical, I guess, is one of the things that just from being out here. Yeah, but.
Well, this is, you know, frankly, this is one of the good things about not being in Harrisburg, right? About not being so involved in that scene is because, you know, is that it does. There is something that to be said is that when you get inside a system, when you get inside, you know, a particular, you know, kind of discourse, particular kind of discussion, that it can be disheartening. But also, I think that when you see things from a different angle, you know, like all these. Like social movements, right? I mean, you know, social movements don't just depend upon the internal workings of politics. Is it really what it just takes? It takes a handful of people. I mean, as the saying goes, right? All you need is a handful of people to change the world. That's the only thing that ever has. And it doesn't mean that a handful of people by themselves do that. But, you know, if people dig in on that issue and then kind of build on the organizing, it can happen. It's just a matter of, you know, some people taking up that banner. I mean, you know, we do what we can here, right? And I think that there's people that are coming, especially those people that have been involved in the Bernie Sanders campaign, I think could do some really awesome stuff on it. So we'll see. I mean, I'm going to leave the candle of hope burning.
All right. Well, let's hope.
Yeah, let's do that.
In my opinion, one of the things we need to push in this state are serious campaign finance reforms. You can basically, if you have $20,000, $30,000, you can give that to whoever you want in one lump sum, and all you got to do is just fill out the thing, and boom, there you are. You have yourself a politician.
Mm-hmm. There you go. There you go. Pennsylvania, shopping for politicians. That's awesome. All right, so this is just going to about do it for this long edition. This is our 10th episode of Raging Chicken Radio's Out the Coop podcast. Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Remember, if you've made it this far in today's podcast, make sure that you go on to Stitcher. Make sure you go on to iTunes. Make sure you go on to Podbean especially. Kind of like the show, comment on it, subscribe to it so we get up there in the ratings and we can get this word out to a lot more people. All right, so we'll be back next week, and we'll have yet another round to wrap up to see what happened in today's West Virginia primary, see where the movements are and the happenings of what's going on in Pennsylvania. All right. See you, Sean. We'll talk to you next week.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
All right. We're out.